Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Bihani Sarkar from the Oriental Institute at the University of Oxford. We'll be talking about her fascinating 2017 OUP publication, Heroic Shaktism, The Cult of Durga in Ancient Indian Kingship. Hello, Bihani, and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Dr. Balkaran, Raj, for inviting me.
I'm Raj, and my students call me Dr. Raj. The only time I see Balkaran is in print. So.
I see. So should I call you Dr. Raj?
No, of course not. No, Raj is fine. If Bihani is fine, I imagine so.
Of course, yeah.
Yes. And we have much to talk about, it appears. Research interests, teaching interests. Let's dive in. So in 2017, you produced this book called Heroic Shaktism. As the subtitle indicates, it's about the cult of Durga, this very famous face of the feminine divine in Indian civilization. And so maybe a great place to start is telling us, what is heroic Shaktism?
Yes. Yeah. So heroic Shaktism is really a phrase that I coined. I mean, it's not a historically attested form. The form really that is historically attested is Shakta. And a Shakta is a worshipper of Shakti, the supreme form of the goddess, and the traditions, the worship and religious and traditions dedicated to Shakti are also called Shakta. Heroic Shaktism is a particular tendency within the Shakta traditions. It is the worship by warriors or lineages that were connected to political power, that ruled kingdoms, of the goddess Durga, who is throughout her development, her primary identity is as a warrior goddess. Just as Athena blesses heroes in the Greek tradition, so Durga too blesses heroes, grants sovereignty, grants kingship, and grants the right to hold power throughout generations. So often we would find in within the story of Indic kingdoms that the right to rule was in fact perceived to be bestowed by the goddess throughout the generations, and hence her worship throughout the generations. From one king to another king was critical. So this is what I mean by heroic Shaktism. It is a form of worshipping the goddess that is particular to the hero. But of course, it's by no means something that is just done by heroes, but rather the rewards that you would get from this worship are rewards that I think, are very much important for a king. How do I ensure that my kingdom remains safe? How do I make sure that my people don't die of, you know, this horrible earthquake or meteor falling from the skies? How do I make sure that my enemy doesn't tie me up and take me away and grab hold of my kingdom? How do I make sure that all these nasty pishachas and bhutas and demons that populate this medieval cosmic world don't attack my community? So the way I do this as a king would be to worship the force, the concentrated power force that is the source of all these gifts and also the source to protect my kingdom from these dangers, which is the goddess.
There's a reason why my first book is called The Goddess and the King.
Yes.
In Indian myth.
Yes.
And so there is this profound, colorful connection between royal power and the goddess Durga in particular.
Yes.
Turning back to your research, you mention in this medieval cosmology. So maybe flesh out for the audience, what time period, you know, what junctures are you looking at in your book, and maybe the sort of like the data, what evidence are you using to craft your argument?
Yes, I am looking at the period which is mainly after the fall of a very important classical royal empire in India called the Guptas. And this is around the middle of the 5th century. And I'm looking particularly at this period when the Gupta Empire begins to wane. And this opens up the space for a number of other competitors, rivals, smaller kingdoms that assert themselves on in this vacuum. So it's the period that is post-Gupta up until the 11th century or 12th century AD. And the reason why I picked this period is because this is the time that all the most of the literature that I work primarily with primary sources in Sanskrit and Prakrit, a few in Prakrit, mainly in Sanskrit. I'm trained as a Sanskritist, and most of the descriptive materials in classical Sanskrit that can tell us anything really substantive about the nature of the deity, who the worshippers are, that can allow us to construct a narrative, a broad narrative, really comes from this period. And interestingly, this is also the period when post-Gupta imperial lineages are asserting themselves. Having said that, I also look at the Gupta period as well, because the roots of this divinity, the roots of this deity, while it goes back much earlier than the Guptas, but we get fascinating accounts from the Gupta period, or from that time, from Vaishnava, from literature from the Vaishnava religious traditions. So it's a big swathe of time that I'm talking about, mainly bit after the Guptas, right up till the 12th century AD, so the what's called the early medieval period. And the sources I'm looking at are primary sources in Sanskrit and Prakrit from this period. These include mythologies, the kind of mythologies that we get in the corpus of Indian legends called the Puranas, which are one of our most important sources, as you know, Raj, very well, of of our study of the Shakta traditions. Of course, we also must look at what are called tantric, often we call tantric esoteric religious traditions as well. We have to look at them together, but sometimes people who are trained within especially in tantric traditions, tend to disregard Puranic sources. I think that you can't do that. You have to look at them as in conversation. I also look at epigraphical sources, because epigraphical sources really give us facts like dates and names and places. This can very help us to plot the abstractions of religious text within an appropriate historical context. I also look at poetic literature. There's a lot of beautiful, magnificent poetry, Shakta poetry dedicated to the goddess. Liturgical traditions, ritual manuals that were used by priests on the ground, that continue to be used actually on the ground, including the Devi Mahatmya, that is a very important part of your life, I know, Raj. So the Devi Mahatmya is, of course, a sacred text that is chanted. So it forms the liturgy of the goddess's worship. So it's very intimately connected to her nature and power. And I also found it important to look at vernacular narratives. And by that, I looked at the original sources where my language skills enabled me that. So I speak Bengali, so I could read Bengali sources. And there were some fascinating accounts, of course, in South Indian languages and in Marathi. These, of course, I had to rely on translations. And ethnographic accounts, the anthropologists in the last 50 years, actually going even further back from the 19th century, have gone to places in the Indic world that continue older forms of kingship, such as in Nepal, or they've gone to villages where many of these early traditions continue, and they've documented it for us. Of course, when looking at these descriptions, we can't see them as you know, they're not accurate reflections of what happened in the post-Gupta scenario, but they are a good indication of how it could have been and what the changes could have been between then and now. Yes, so those are my sources and historical periods.
You certainly look at a wide range of sources over this period to map the sort of the chronology of the, as you call it, the cult of Durga, of the worship of this goddess, and her role, her significance in the life of kings, in the institution of kingship. Mm. And so what is your central argument? You make an argument based on, for example, to what do we owe Durga's prominence and usage in this capacity?
Yes. So I would say the main arguments of the book I can maybe summarize in the following way. The first is that the spread of Durga's worship in this period is connected with the rise of early Indian military lineages and early Indian kingdoms. The second argument is that within this story, the nature of the deity changed, that it wasn't a static kind of deity, that in the beginning, this deity begins as much in the way that the roots of Shiva go back to the ferocious Rudra, the Vedic Rudra, in the same way that the roots of this particular goddess goes back to a rather ferocious and ambivalent deity who's connected to sleep, who's connected to death, and connected particularly to Krishna. She is regarded as Krishna's sister. And from these, let's say, marginal roots, because she's still a kind of deity that's thought to ward away dangers and is slightly dangerous herself. In this narrative of the rise of this goddess's worship, she transforms into a much more expansive persona, a great goddess, a goddess who represents motherhood, benevolence, the source of boons, the source of protection. So this is what I wanted to emphasize as well, that there's a shift in the character, the persona of the deity of Durga from a version of a goddess of sleep associated with Navami in the monsoon period, to a much more expansive, cohesive, ubiquitous deity, a deity who's present everywhere, a great goddess. The third argument that I wanted to make is that she becomes representative of local goddesses, that there were a number of local goddesses worshipped, still worshipped in parts of India. Historians have surmised that many of these goddesses might have have non-Brahmanical origins, that they were worshipped by the local indigenous population. Durga becomes associated with these goddesses and sort of is the face for, is their face. She allows them to acquire a prestigious status within classical Hinduism. And I suppose my final argument is to do with the Navaratra. I felt that the history of the heroic Shaktism cannot be told properly without etching a narrative of the Navaratra festival, the festival of the nine nights. And my argument there was that initially it's a Vaishnava festival on Navami to placate this wild goddess who grants kingship to kings. But it expands into a much more capacious 9-day grand ceremony, such as we have now. And of course, the deities change from a ferocious to a more benevolent figure, as reflected in the change in the Navaratra as well. So these are the various arguments that I hoped I was able to make, in the book.
What do you say about Skanda and the goddess?
Yes, that's an interesting and rather complicated question. So Skanda, I mean, a lot of work has been done on Skanda Kartikeya. Skanda Kartikeya was an important god of kingship at a very early period. But Skanda Kartikeya also has a presence in medical literature as a deity of possession. But there is in this, historians of South Asian religions have pointed out that Skanda makes this elevation from a deity possession, someone who's surrounded by the matris. He's associated with these seven goddesses called the mothers, who are again associated with fertility, childbirth, possession as well. And then he becomes, he's elevated as a god of kingship. He's also absorbed within the Shaiva traditions and is considered Shiva's son, the young prince Kumara, who leads the army of heaven. Now, what interested me about Skanda was that in the Mahabharata, in the Aranyaka Parvan, there is a narrative of Skanda. And there, he slays Durga's arch nemesis, Mahisha, the buffalo demon. That was the first time I thought, you know, this is really interesting. And what's going on here? And fortunately, a number of scholars had I think there were, I might be mistaken, but at the time I saw that there were two scholars who had noticed this and had also remarked on this. But it's, you know, they hadn't gone further into it. So I thought, Right. I think this is important, and we've got to delve into it. Now, in a nutshell, again, what I've presented about the relationship between Skanda and Durga in the book, I am aware that it is a sort of working hypothesis, no doubt based on, very much based on evidence. And I'm open to changing my ideas if appropriate evidence is presented to me. But in a nutshell, it seems that some of the early, the myth of Skanda and the myth of the goddess share very close correspondences. So the narrative traditions of both deities share very close correspondence. And furthermore, you also have very common deity groups you have common deity groups to both of them. So the Matris and these this retinue of strange, fascinating characters that surround Skanda. You also have them in Durga's case. And in fact, later on, especially in the worship of Durga, you cannot worship Durga without first worshipping or without worshipping her avarana, her retinue, the Saptamatris, all the yoginis, together with Durga. And within Skanda's time as well, these deities held a function in safeguarding spaces, safe, especially in things like crossroads, marketplaces where lots of people gather. So you safeguard that space by worshipping the Matris. They serve a very similar purpose in Durga's case as well. The worship of Durga in the midst of her Saptamatra and 64 yoginis is taught on Mahashtami. And on Mahanavami within the Eastern traditions. And there is this very strong link between Skanda and Durga as well, apart, of course, also from the slaying of Mahisha. We could keep on talking about this. I mean, go on expanding. The details of this are really treated in the book. But I also feel that there is, present the evidence in the book as well, that there are aspects in her mythology of aspects of how she is presented as a royal figure that I feel are very similar, harmonious to the way that Skanda is presented. Before the Devi Mahatmya or these early old Skanda Purana, these early mythic traditions, if you go back to the Vaishnava goddess, she's not really a goddess of the battlefield or of armies. She's a goddess of the monsoon. She's of course a dangerous figure, but she's associated with skies. Kings, of course, worship her, but she doesn't have this whole officialness about her at all. The association with dharma, is something that that is made at a later phase with the goddess, particularly with the Mahishasura and the demon slaying, all the Ashumba Nishumba myths. But in the early Vaishnava strand, that association that she restores dharma by restoring the gods to the heaven, that association is not explicit.
Until the Devi Mahatmya, you'd say.
Until the Devi Mahatmya, yes. Where it is, of course, dharma is the key thing there.
And Kshatriya dharma. Really, like the imperative to protect that the perils abound and you have to fight fire with fire. You need something dangerous to deal with the dangers of spiritual dangers, social dangers.
Yes. Although having said that, I've recently come across. So in the book, I didn't really look much in depth in Vedic materials. That's, I think, a great shortcoming. It's simply because I needed much more training in that to get into it. But recently I've been made aware by Professor Lubin, who's just written about certain texts within the Vedic tradition that describe mantras of Durga, that within the Vedic tradition as well, I mean, his argument is that these mantras to the goddess are being retrofitted into Vedic materials. But whenever they're being retrofitted, it's still probably quite early. Within those mantras, she is being evoked as a benevolent, auspicious figure. Of course, kingship and protection from danger, all of that comes in, but as a much bigger goddess, not just a small goddess of dangers and protection of the king from the dangers, but someone who protects homes as well, because the context in which these mantras are taught is the Griha Sutra context, the domestic ritual. So yes, there is this connection with warrior culture, but I think from a very early period, and this is also the reason why the cult spread, she becomes much bigger than that. She also offers goods and things and protection and bounty and peace and all of those things that also, I think, are fundamental to good kingship. You don't just go around conquering people and killing and cutting off people's heads and, being all really brutal. No, you governance means dharmic governance and looking after your subjects and making gifts.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, for example, in the there's much discourse on the nature of the proper king, but for example, in the opening lines of the Devi Mahatmya, we're told about this king who was a noble king because he treated his subjects as if they were his children. Exactly. Not in this sort of modern sort of, oh, who wants to be infantilized? No, it's that to nurture, to provide for, to care. And so the dharma of the king and the dharma of the mother are not so dissimilar.
Yes. You see. Yes, I certainly think so. There is the king's role is also to nourish, to nourish, and rather than to take and aggrandize. And within Indian kingship, that is very much there. Of course, the king's also supposed to uphold the Chaturvarna, the four castes. That's one of his primary duties. But to look after those who fall within the four castes as well. But coming back to the Kshatriya thing that you had mentioned, I just want to say this before I forget it, that she is not simply in this early literature, there's a very close connection that is shown between her and the outcast king. This figure that's always typified in Sanskrit literature as the Shabara, the outcast. That's just a generic term for anyone who doesn't come within the four caste system, the caste.
The Mlecha.
Yeah, the later on in materials that we find in the Devi Purana, she's also said to be the goddess of the Mlechas. So it is, I think, the earlier that we go into this literature, she is a deity of kings, but not just of the Hindu king, but it's a much more ecumenical form of kingship. You know, it includes any king.
And also this theological, philosophical vision of the goddess that's, you know, really woven together through narrative. It's not exposition per se. Her penchant for paradox, right? She is the patron of the center and of the periphery, right?
Exactly. I think you put it so beautifully there. I think that's really one wonderful way of that you can really think about it, that she is the patron goddess of both the center and the periphery. And isn't that how good government should also work? That she stands not just for the center, but also for the periphery. Okay.
Indeed. No, that's great. I mean, clearly, I mean, there's much to... Your book is filling a massive niche, and maybe much about Durga that we may assume or internalize, but you rigorously demonstrate the influence of the cult of Durga and the relationship she has to the life of Indian kings. And indeed, what I find so interesting is that we have such different methodologies, but our findings really corroborate each other in a sense, where I look at a synchronic... I look at the Devi Mahatmya synchronically,
yes,
and sort of juice the Hindu imaginaire.
Of course. Right?
And then you basically are able to show that this is how it's been iterated. This is how it's been in vogue at various points in history between the 13th centuries. Mm-hmm. And I find that so interesting. Independently, it may be obvious that the Devi is patron of kings and many think, actually, I mean, I've come across the argument that the merchant is the hero of the Devi Mahatmya because he asks for moksha. He asks for moksha, and the foolish king is still attached. No. But no, it occurred to me that no, that the text was maybe even in a slightly subversive way in terms of Upanishadic ideology. It's saying, no, actually, the king is the hero, the one who wants to remain in the world for the welfare of the world.
Mm.
Right?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Anyhow.
I think, Raj, if I'd spend my entire life in this kind of in synchronic work, because mythology to me is so fascinating and always playing in my head. And every time I read one of these myths, I can, you know, thousands of connections and things. If I went into myth, I'd probably just work with myth. So next time I do work on myth, it'll probably be just myth. And the Devi Mahatmya in itself, that narrative, it is so rich in what it suggests.
Profound.
You find out so many, I do feel that one can intelligently read historical events within mythic tropes, especially myths that are cultural myths, like the Devi Mahatmya, that we can read historical process as conveyed through imaginative devices. And if we read a number of these, we can, I think, piece together that narrative. Of course, all this has to be done rigorously and painstakingly, otherwise we might be saying any old thing. That you know, look at the way the Devi Mahatmya myth is being interpreted now. I find it fascinating that myths still continue in culture, that Mahishasura, within I think the last 30 years or 40 years, contemporary Indians have begun to interpret Mahishasura as the tribal whose lands are being taken away from him, the outcast, and Durga is a symbol of Brahmanical Hinduism, that is treading on the tribal. So these narratives continue. I mean, I had somebody ask me in an angry way that, why you support, you know, why you don't you know that this is what Mahishasura stands? He stands for the oppressed tribal. And I didn't have anything to say because I thought, how amazing that you actually see these resonances. And that just shows to me the power of this myth, that these symbols are so connected with social event that they can suggest something even now.
It seems to me, I mean, who knows what was happening in the world behind the texts around the time of the Guptas, but we know that something mammoth was happening.
Yes.
for all of a sudden a theology centered on the great goddess to be, as I put it, Trojan horsed into the Puranic fold in this text. Clearly much was happening. And clearly the theology of the goddess is as much about paradox as this historical moment where tribal and antinomian traditions are being folded into a cohesive religious vision. I mean, one can easily make the argument, maybe now, post recent scholarship, that, okay, well, Durga represents the state and sort of the Brahmanical powers that be. Having said that, I mean, she is intoxicated in one episode. She accepts the blood of the limbs of the merchant and the king in the final frame. Clearly, there's much more going on here.
Yes. Right?
Clearly.
Yes. In fact, this particular practice of offering, the hero offering blood from, I think it's the thigh, the shoulder, the main body parts of the thigh, arm as well, to the goddess. This, it keeps coming back in different examples of historical materials. We have these depicted in iconography. There are these marvelous South Indian 7th century sculptures of the goddess surrounded by heroic worshippers, ready to, you know, actually ready, one about to cut off his head and offer to the goddess. And similarly, in other, I mean, I've seen in Navaratra ritual manuals that come from the kingdom of Mithila, as late about from the 13th, 14th century, that there is this entire section starting from Mahashtami, Mahanavami, of rituals of the hero offering blood. And I think what's, you can interpret that in many ways, but I think what's happening there is that this is a sign of a true hero, and it's self-sacrifice is what a good soldier does, that I'm putting myself out on the line to protect my people. And if we go back to the myth of the goddess in the Harivamsa, one of the early myths, she sacrifices her life for her brother, Krishna. Kamsa comes and kills her. She's ready to do this to save her brother. And Krishna is saved thereby. And when Kamsa dashes her to the rock, she flies up in the air and she says that, you know, this was planned all along and I'm going to, you're just this horrible, you're terrible and I'm going to drink your blood when you die. But what happens there is that she epitomizes what a true warrior does, that they put themselves out on the line, they sacrifice themselves for someone else. And I think the offering of blood is linked with that, because it's a practice that seems to be associated mainly with warriors. So king, you know, not everybody is asked in ritual manuals to do this. Only the king, or we find in depictions in sculpture, only a warrior, literature, only a Shabara hero. There are examples in stories about Shivaji, the great Maratha ruler. There are these Marathi stories where he's ready to cut his head again, styling himself in that way that, you know, I am the true warrior. I am going to cut my head off for Bhavani. And but Bhavani, of course, in those stories, she intercedes and she says, no, you know, you're not going to do that. So I think the offering of blood by a hero is linked to renunciation and sacrifice.
It's an evocative overlap between the sacrifice of battle and ritual sacrifice, in a sense.
Exactly. That the true king, the true Kshatriya, the true Veera, will go out on the battle, and the battle is a kind of, you're offering your life to the ritual space, in the ritual space of the battle, and you will, the glory that you will earn at the end of the battle is heaven. And you're right, it's a kind of, it's very interesting what you said, because yes, the offering of blood may seem to be a ritual encapsulation of what happens in the battlefield.
Well, for me, that was sort of that stood out from the beginning of my doctoral studies. I had a conference presentation I had to prepare for, and I thought, well, why not start now and analyze the frame of this text? And it just stood out to me as very important to the text. I don't know what the text is saying. I know that the text is saying something very important.
Yeah.
Right. And so for me, it was like, this is a valorization of Kshatriya Dharma. If we want to sort of crudely think of, well, is this, you know, is this valorizing the Dharma of the Brahmanas that's more ascetic and, you know, I just want moksha? Or is it valorizing the Dharma of the Kshatriyas? You know, I strive for the welfare of the world. You know, I the imperiled are more important than my salvation in some sense.
Yes. So this question to you, Raj. I mean, what you just said prompted me. Then, if it is, and it's a question I'm also asking myself, actually, that if this is a valorization of Kshatriya Dharma, then what about the role of this of the merchant there, and the merchant who goes through exactly the same experience as the king? Here is this merchant. They're both affluent men, from the story. They're all men of both men of power in different spheres, finance and politics, but they are both tricked, dispossessed by their families. The people closest to them have betrayed them, and they've lost everything. So we see this narrative of loss. It begins in a tragic moment. They're these two characters, once powerful, once glorious, but reduced to a state of nothing. And for me, when I read it, one of the points that the text is making is presenting their equality. That this grand king and this grand merchant, at the end of the day, they're actually just the same people. Otherwise I'm not being, how else can I understand the role of that merchant there? And
this is sort of, you know, just to sort of reflect on the spot, I touch on this a little bit in the book, the Goddess and the King, which is more about the king, obviously. But for me, one can read that really brief but potent frame as a stream of consciousness, where these are parts of self. These really strike me as parts of self. You know, the voice of reason and wisdom, the go-getter, right? The more detached witness, right? Yes. These are parts of self. So I really read the merchant and the king as balancing each other out. And what I argue is that the text has to, part of the project of the epics and the Puranas is to encode what I call the Dharmic double helix. Pravriti and Nivriti have to be paradoxically united in a way that will never make sense. And that's why we have kings who end up in the forests. That's why we have Rama as a pseudo-ascetic, for example. Why does he need to wear bark garments to fulfill his father's boon? There's no reason for that, right? This is the double helix. So we need the Nivritic valorization, to be preserved, to be a classical Hindu text.
Yes.
I think that's the role the merchant plays. Also as an aspect of self, you know, there's a reason why she's, you know, bhukti mukti badayini, right? She'll give both. And we don't necessarily get the sense that the king is as infatuated at the outset as he is. He may have benefited from the jnana of Sage Mathas, but now he's sort of in this space of, you know, I understand I'm not propelled by Maya as I was before. I'm not despondent. I'm not dejected. Nevertheless, in full awareness, I wish for my kingdom back and I wish to be Lord of an age.
This is very important, I think, what you said, that this, the importance of paradox, and you mentioned that before, because the goddess herself is paradox, that there are both these contradictory aspects within her. In the first charita of the Devi Mahatmya, the sage, as you will remember, explains to the merchant and the king that the goddess is the principle of Maya. The principle of and Maya is paradox. Maya is samsara. It is your life in transmigration. So the goddess is the principle that entraps you in samsara and this continuous life. So in a way, that's a kind of almost a negative picture. But at the same time, she's also the principle of liberation. She not only is she Maya samsara, but she can also liberate both of these devotees so that they acquire freedom from samsara. And it's after the sage explains the importance of life as paradox, goddess as paradox, they understand the importance of paradox, your double helix, and that's when they start to worship her. But they need to, I think, the point of the narrative is that they need to understand paradox.
Well, I agree entirely. And what's interesting to me is in looking at the narrative structure and this kind of lens of frame narratives, there is the text oscillates between pravritti and nivritti in the frame, in that they have a nivritic problem. We are dejected by this world that will never satisfy anyone, and it's full of evil, it's full of greed, it's full of corrupt ministers. The world is a problem. And we have to, you know, I'm a king without power. What is that? You know, I'm a merchant without wealth. What is that? We're dispossessed. We're like, you know, walking zombies wondering how the heck we got here. And that's the problem that's presented to be solved with the council of the Mathas. But that problem is framed by the first problem of a noble and wise and good king being usurped by corruption. So the initial problem, the text says, is that we have a social problem.
Yes.
And then it goes to the metaphysical existential problem. And it's so interesting that the king says, the sage says, look, you know, basically the approach is, why do any of us go to a guru or teacher or coach? We're suffering, right? Mm. They approach a sage and they're like, look, like I'm beside myself. This merchant's beside himself. You know, Swamiji, help us. What's happening here? And he's like, oh, sit, have a chai. This is not a big deal. Look, see these ridiculous birds that are flying back and forth, thinking their babies will love them forever. And as soon as they feed them enough, the babies fly away. They're propelled by Maya. We're all in this matrix and they're engaged. But this is what prompts the king to ask for more is after he says this, after he talks about the sway of Maya and the problem of attachment, he says, yeah, she is the Maya. She is the liberation. Oh, and she's the sovereign of all sovereigns. That's his hook. Yeah. He's like, oh, tell me about power. Tell me about sovereignty.
Exactly. And again, if we take one step back and go back to the historical narrative that we started with, I think this whole metaphysical dimension of the goddess as Maya, samsaric maya, the cause of samsaric bondage, but also the principle of liberation. I think this was there, but it somehow grew around this core of giver of sovereignty, that somehow that she is attached to this state of social crisis. She's worshipped in a state of social crisis. And what you just mentioned, the Nivritti period, the period of crisis that happens to any person engaged in the world, a merchant, a financier, and a politician, people most prone to ups and downs, actually. And this is the deity who's very much linked with these situations. The more also, I don't know if it struck you, I'm sure it has, Raj, that a very similar situation is also what happens at the Gita in a way, that these that Arjuna is in a similar state of
That's exactly the corollary, the analog I look at in the first or the second chapter of my book is I plot the double helix in the frame of the Devi Mahatmya, and I plot the double helix in the frame of the Gita. And what I'm saying is that they're both couching the existential problem as dependent upon ultimately resolving the social problem.
Yes.
The pendulum has to swing the other way. Yes. From Vedic world affirmation to Upanishadic yes. world denial, the pendulum has to say, we need both this spiritual apex.
Exactly.
We also need good kings and protection in the world.
Exactly.
We need to find a way to bring them together.
Exactly.
Right?
And I think the context which brings these two together is a tragic occurrence, is calamity. Because those are the situations in which these characters, and I think most of us, a lot of us, would ask such deep existential questions, would search for some kind of answer. And the answer in this case is always posited as the goddess. But the answer is provided in this context of social breakdown that leads to an existential and inner breakdown.
Which we're all living through as a species as we speak.
And as the Buddhists would say, we always will, and it'll never end, you know. yes.
So what, in terms of your book, was there anything else that you wanted to talk about in terms of the content of the book that we didn't touch on?
I think, you know, this conversation has gone through so many interesting and especially with the myth part of it, that was really enjoyable. I have nothing really further to add, except I would probably ask you more about this whole the comparison that you make with the Gita, that I really find fascinating in the situations of Arjuna and these
Suratha,
Suratha and Samadhi. There's one difference though. I don't think that they go through as much of a traumatic physical process as Arjuna does. Arjuna is incapacitated by grief. I mean, he's really going through something terrible.
Well, part of that is that there's much, much, much more space in the Gita than in the opening frame of the Devi Mahatmya that's telegraphic. I think Coburn even uses that term. It's telegraphic in its brevity, but it's so, so rich, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's just so little room. But basically, the king's beside himself sitting in the outskirts of the ashram. And the merchant comes along and he's basically like, why so glum, chum? Like, what's your, you look how I feel, what's happening here? Like, they're both beside themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's just, I think it's the space, right? I mean, the king is so beside himself. He's mounted his horse alone. He's lost his power. He's sitting there thinking about his elephant. He's lamenting. But rather than give that lamentation 18 shlokas, it's in one shloka type of thing. So I think it's a question of just how compact that first frame is.
Although I have, you know, absolutely, but you know, in poetic receptions of this tale, that moment, the that the power, the emotional power of that moment is seized on by composers, and they really build it up. And the lamentation of Suratha in say, there's a reception, a Kavya reception called the Durga Vilasa that I'm working on as well. And that moment is so beautifully expanded. You know, this lament that goes where he really pours his heart out. What drew me to these narratives is the humanity of this narrative, that these great and mighty characters are going through something that is very core to human experience, and that is grief. And the goddess is connected to that experience, alleviating that experience, but also connecting. She is also the cause, isn't she? She is Maya, which is the world in its, in all its ups and downs and paradoxes. It's good times and bad times, simplistically.
Well, it's certainly, I mean, isn't that the power of myth, right? Isn't that the appeal to the, in that it encapsulates what goes on between their ears in a way that treaties can't. Through narrative, human stories, right? That the stories we tell civilizationally and the stories we tell day to day, the stories that last are the ones that relate to our experience.
I think, right? So, yes.
There's a reason why we still see issues that we can relate to in these ancient tales. Mm. And that, I think that's the very process whereby they endure.
Yes, and experiences, and the goddess is connected to experience, to human experience in the world, that unlike other divinities who are sort of quite, especially, you know, following the Upanishadic model, removed, far apart, separate, just, you know, simply witnessing.
100%. One of the things that I noted that I may well develop, I actually presented it for the first time. There was an online week in Tantra School at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, and I ended up giving a talk on this, basically asking the question, you know, is the Devi Mahatmya a tantric text in terms of its narrative themes, not in terms of its ritual usage? And I noted this when I was dissertating, and it's something I may develop, but the Devi only ever emerges from the body of another being.
Yes, yes. There are all the myths where she's, especially if you look at the early, the Skanda Purana tale, all these kind of morphings, bodies morphing into another. It's kind of like an Ovidian metamorphosis. It's one body morphing into another. It's amazing.
It really. It is my view that certainly the authors of the Devi Mahatmya are aware of tantric practice, but irrespective of that view,
I think so.
Have to think about, it's utterly clear that immanence, divine immanence, is celebrated in the text. That this, what clinched it for me was the Yadevi Stuti in chapter 5, where the gods on high are appealing to the mother beyond, and how are they appealing to her? They're in heaven, and they're looking up to the for the help of the Devi, and they're like, oh, great glorious goddess who lives in all beings, like in the creepy crawlies on the earth, in humans and animals and gods, you live in all beings. And it's this paradox, right? They're summoning her from above as that which lives as the very biorhythms in all beings.
Exactly. And I think that's the paradox, that she is both the thing that transcends transmigratory reality, so phenomenal reality, but she's also phenomenal reality and the cause of phenomenal reality as well. That she's both these things and more, that she's connected to our experience. And in a way that, you know, Shiva or Vishnu, the only kind of correspondence I can find is with the idea of the Bodhisattva, who will intercede in times of trouble. Even perhaps Vishnu's viewers and avatars will come at certain phases of human history.
Certainly her function is, you know, it's basically the function of the avatar writ large, you know.
Yes.
But having said that, there is this comparable to a mother tongue versus a father tongue, right? This idea of, you know, whether Sanskrit was a father tongue. There's something very immediate about the way in which the goddess is described. And I think that's part of the rationale of using the feminine gender, right? I think that's part of the rationale. It's immediate, right? Mm-hmm. It's here, it's now. She's beyond as well, but yes. She's immediate. She's intimate. She's here. This is her. The Maya is the Devi, as well as transcendence of the Maya is the Devi. Mm. And what Sudata learns is to be empowered within the Maya, as opposed to being disempowered.
Exactly. And this is the lesson that the two learn, isn't it? The merchant and the king, they are disempowered and then they are re-empowered at the end. And that's one of the messages of the Devi Mahatmya.
And this paradox of being the apex of both temporal and spiritual power. Mm. She is power. She is the height of power. Exactly. Right? And so the height of power in the world is the king. And the height of power beyond the world is one who attains moksha, who goes beyond I-ness and my-ness. I believe that's the way the text describes it. Mm. A fascinating discussion. We are soon to be commencing. Podcasts are timeless. Someone may be listening to this podcast 6 months from now. But it is today, it's October 11th, 2020. And so soon we'll be starting the Goddess Festival.
Yes.
So this discussion is timely. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're doing for the festival in terms of the Devi Mahatmya, in terms of teaching. Tell us a little bit about what opportunities folks may have.
Well, thanks so much for bringing that up. During Shashti, Saptami, Ashtami, Mahanavami, Vijayadashami, I'll be reading from the Devi Mahatmya. I'll be reciting and also providing translations while I read. And I'm going to read, obviously, ideally, I would have read the whole thing as the proper Chandipatha should do, but I'll go through the Shumbha Nishumbha Vada section, which covers quite most of it. So I'll be reading that, and you can see more information about it on my professional website. Please kind of register, and it's very cheap. It's £32 for all the five readings. They're about 1.5 hours each. And I thought that this would be a befitting way to mark the Navaratri and also to re-experience the Shumbha Nishumbha Vada part, which is one of the earlier sort of narratives within the demon slaying narratives of the goddess. If you're interested, I mean, please, you can email me at info@bihanisarkar.com, or you can see more about the course at bihanisarkar.com, and please do subscribe. It starts on the 22nd of October, so there's still time to register. So it's 22nd right up until I think the 28th or the 9th. So, and I record all the sessions and you'll be getting them. So do sign up.
Fantastic. I was actually quite pleased to see you offering this online adventure, this learning adventure for people interested. The world is changing. Initially, I had no idea. Online teaching was something I did sort of on the side.
Yeah.
For 3 or 4 years now, maybe 5 actually. And now all of a sudden it's needed at the academy. And more I really applaud scholars for taking the plunge and presenting their stuff online, because there's a critical mass of the public that really want quality material. And if the experts aren't presenting it online,
yes,
if the chefs aren't cooking, they're forced to half-ass food, right?
Exactly. And, you know, I enjoy communicating. I've enjoyed my online teaching experience. And usually there are people I cannot teach, here where I'm sitting at now. Right now, there are people all over the world. A lot of them are Indians from India who are, professionally engaged, but they want to go back and relearn and actually hold conversations. So I found it a fantastic way of sharing all this kind of specialized and great research that is happening right now in our field with a broader audience, but bringing them into the conversation as well, because I feel that with things like Hindu studies, Sanskrit, it's such a divided world. There are specialists and then there are politicized groups. And, we need to create a space where we can really just have a scholarly, unmotivated conversations that are conversations just for the pleasure of having them.
Indeed. And that's very much the space of the podcast. And that's why I think there's great synergy here. So for those of you listening, we have been talking with Dr. Bihani Sarkar of the Oriental Institute at the University of Oxford on her 2017 OUP publication, Heroic Shaktism. Check it out. And also definitely go to BihaniSarkar.com. And if you get this in time, then by all means, register for her her Navaratri goddess extravaganza. It was great having you on the program. We'll continue chatting, I'm sure, beyond. But thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Raj. That was lovely. Thank you. Namaste.
Until next time, keep reading, keep listening, stay safe, and keep contemplating the paradoxical mystery that is the Mahadevi. I'm at rajbalkran.com. Feel free to message me if I can be of service with book recommendations for future podcasts and whatnot. Take good care. Bye-bye.